Good morning and welcome to the November 18th, 2019 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. I'd like to thank everybody for coming today and ask everyone to please silence your cell phones and electronic devices. The commission completes its work and makes all decisions in public. The public may request to be placed on the agenda, and at this time, no one has made that request. Our study session begins this morning at 10 a.m. with the business session beginning at 1 p.m. However, we welcome the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come up to the microphone, use the microphone, and state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have four commissioners present. Commissioner Arsenault is attending a conference and is not here and is absent today, excused. Also attending is General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfing. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute led by Curtis Clark. Thank you, Curtis.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I guess I'll just sit here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come in and share the safety minute today. I'm Curtis Cole. I'm the district's manager of business intelligence and data analytics. I thought since the Thanksgiving holiday is fast approaching that it might be appropriate to have some safety tips around the food preparation in the kitchen. So to ensure that you and the family and guests have a great time, be sure to follow some common food preparation safety. According to the Partnership for Food Safety Education, the first one is to wash hands frequently. Keep prepared foods and other side dishes, like your green bean casserole, away from the raw turkey or other poultry so that we don't have any cross-contamination. Make sure you cook the food thoroughly using a thermometer to check for food temperature of at least 140 degrees Fahrenheit on other dishes, and the turkey and stuffing, they say 165. Refrigerate leftovers within 2 hours at 40 degrees or below. And then also they recommend ditching the leftovers after 4 days to be safe, which is a new one for me. That's an interesting one. To be prepared while cooking, it is a perfect time to ensure that you have a working fire extinguisher in the kitchen. It's really important to make sure that you have an ABC rated fire extinguisher in your kitchen. If they're supposed to be inspected monthly, if you haven't inspected yours recently, make sure you inspect your fire extinguisher to make sure it is charged. An important part of inspecting while a fire extinguisher is to turn it upside down and to hit it with a mallet or something to make sure that the medium inside that fire extinguisher is loosened up and isn't caked on so that when you try to use it, it actually works. And then while you're doing that, remember that the PASS acronym, P-A-S-S, which is pull the pin, aim at the base of the fire, squeeze the trigger, and sweep from the base of the fire and work your way up. And if you do that, we'll make sure that the rolls that were left in the oven are extinguished. So after that, have a fun and safe holiday for everybody. Thank you.
How did you know I've done that with rolls in the oven?
But you didn't mention the cranberry sauce. I don't know.
Yeah. Curtis, my apologies. I said Clark instead of Cole, so sorry about that.
Thank you.
Okay. Commissioners, we've been presented with an agenda. Items on the agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda, or on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commissioner. Do I hear any such request or additions to our agenda? Hearing none, the agenda stays as written, as posted. Okay. Steve.
I want to start off today with our winner of Cycle Personal Ownership for this month, Edie Risen. Would you come on up and join us, please? So, first of all, I hope you will notice that we have changed the posters on the wall. We now have the new vision, mission, and value statement, and we've got a bigger best for the most for the longest in the back
it's
there.
It's very readable.
Right. And the reason I point those out is one of the things that we decided that we were going to emphasize more in the values component was collaboration as part of the trustworthiness value. You can't. At the very end, under trustworthiness, we added collaboration. And one of the reasons that we selected Idri from the nominations was this was a, we thought, really great example of working in a collaborative fashion. I'll just take a second to read that Idri participated in a meeting with an outside regulatory agency to negotiate a permit needed to perform maintenance work at Tumwater Dam. The district's team had reached a stalemate with the agency representative, and they refused to grant authorization to do the work. So imagine the difficulty that would be. You know, we've been working to try to understand what's going on at Tumwater Dam, particularly whether there's undercutting of the structure there. Idri was able to assess the agency's concern and propose a reasonable compromise, which was supported by district staff before the meeting ended, and she was able to get the agency to agree to that. So it's a pretty big deal. It's one of those things that we really needed to get the work done. We needed to work through this issue, and we needed somebody who could come in with the ability to be able to find ways to be able to work collaboratively and get to a good solution. So we thought this was a particularly good example of one of the things that we're trying to emphasize with our values here. So, Idri, congratulations and thank you. And as you know, you have the opportunity, but not the requirement, to address the board if you'd like.
No, I just thank you. I appreciate it. It's really nice to be recognized by my peers, especially. So, that was really
cool. May I ask, how'd you do it?
They wanted us to use a different method, basically, that wouldn't have worked well for us to see what was happening underneath the spillway. So, we just came to a compromise where we basically did a little bit of both. They wanted us to use gravel-filled sandbags. We needed to use sand-filled sandbags. They put the sand on the inside of the gravel. And their concern was if one broke, that the sand would be washed down the river. So
good job. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank congratulations you. And thank you. Next up is a really fun one. I want to invite Randall Phillips and Terry McFadden to come up. So my understanding is these gentlemen have a presentation for the board, but I'll start by saying Terry has just achieved a major accomplishment, becoming the longest serving ever PUD employee at more than 43 years, as I understand it. So we want to welcome you, congratulate you, and I understand you had some things you wanted to share as well.
Absolutely. So I'm Randall Phillips. I'm manage the warehouses here at the PUD.
And I'm Terry McFadden. I'm materials warehouse foreman for Wenatchee, Leavenworth, and Chelan warehouses.
So as Steve just said, this is a momentous occasion. Terry has achieved something that's just huge. So it's 43.26 and counting. So, and the reason we say that is because the fellow that he just beat was 43.25. So, got to make that really clear. So, Terry is the longest all-time tenured employee, continuous employment for Chelan County PUD and Puget Power and Light before Chelan County. Huge accomplishment, very huge. So Terry and I thought, okay, how do we bring this information to you? We don't spend much time up here, and so we thought we'd just do the same thing that we do in the warehouse. So we have a lot of fun. So we're going to present this to you with a little bit of fun today. So ready for that?
Hey, Terry? Uh-huh.
I'm ready.
Here we go. Okay, so Terry, if you talk with Terry any length of time, Terry uses the cliche, back in the day. So you're going to hear that. Well, back in the day. Back in the day. So we're going to go back to 1976. Back in the day, 1976. And we're going to walk you through what was going on in 1976. So as I look around the room, 1976, I would think that most of us in here were teenagers, and some of us weren't even born yet. That's what I see here. So what was going on in 1976? So a little trivia. So this might be a hard one. But so what do you think might have been the top box office movie in 1976? That'd be a hard one. So, actor is Sylvester Stallone.
Oh, Rocky.
Rocky?
The original Rocky. Yes, very good. So, also, Clint Eastwood was pretty popular. And what was maybe a movie that he put out in 76?
Good, Bad, and the Ugly?
Dirty Harry?
Well, close. It was The Enforcer. Oh. Enforcer. But here's the thing. There's three keywords in that that most men would remember. There it was. Make my day. 1976. Moving along here. So now we're going to talk about the music charts in 76. So, Rebecca, if you could play the first clip.
Yeah, she could.
And the song? One more time. If you leave tonight, very good. You'll take away the... Okay.
Still one of Park Hill's favorites.
Yeah. Okay, the second clip, please.
Electric Light.
There it was. So that's Manfred Mann, Blinded by the Light.
Oh.
Very good. You guys remember 76 well? Very good. So also in 76, it was the 200th bicentennial for the country. And that was huge. And also that was the year that Coca-Cola introduced their most popular jingle. Maybe you can remember what that was? That was it. I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Very good.
Yeah.
So that was the environment that Terry was in 1976 when he actually started work at the district. He started in 1973. It took him 3.5 years applying to get on at the district. So Terry and I are going to do a couple of questions and answers here for you. Kind of bring you through that time. So Terry, 1973, what was it that made you think you wanted to be employed at Chelan PUD?
Well, I'll tell you, Randall, this is how I felt. At age 14, I started working after school, weekends and summers, at my father's and uncle's business, Max Tire Service in Chelan. During my junior high and high school years while working, I was able to meet the PUD people that worked in Chelan at that time and their crews and usually work on their vehicles in some fashion and got to know them pretty well. They're still liked and they're still respected and they still work in Chelan County. So then, I decided right then at age 18 when I got out of high school, Chelan County was the place of business I wanted my career in life to be. It took me 3.5 years applying at Chelan County PUD from time to time. When actually there were only approximately 230 employees here at that time. In 1979, I got an interview to be a meter reader for the district and customer accounting, and I got the job. It was my dream job. My meter reading route was 75% residential electrical meters from the Clackam Valley to the start of Pashaston, Washington, and my 25% other meters were businesses from the same area. After about 1.5 years, I moved into the application desk, closing bills, audit clerk, and finally special entries clerk. I knew at some time that I needed to have a physical job to make me sane, so I kept looking. Finally, a job opening at the Wenatchee warehouse came open, and as a warehouseman, I applied and was awarded it in 1979. So the Wenatchee main warehouse houses over 2,500 moving stock items. The materials are valued there today at over $5 million. Okay, Randall, it's yours.
Okay. 43.26 years and counting. It's a long time. Terry, you've probably seen some differences in the district over that time from 1976 to 2019. Want to share some of those differences with us?
Yes, I will. So I'm going to start with... Rock Island Powerhouse 2, now down there on the Malaga side. So another warehouseman and I were asked to make warehouses there up on the hill above the dam and to take care of all the construction people and those kinds of folks. So we worked directly with Stone & Webster and the French during those 2.5-3 years there. And eventually we got established as warehousemen. And so when we got done with that, the district really liked what we did, and they didn't have a warehouse group at Rocky Reach Dam or a warehouse. They just how it worked, they just had buildings with stuff in it, right? So We went to Rocky Reach at Riverside Warehouse, and we produced another warehouse there. And they decided they wanted to have permanent warehousemen there. And so they made jobs for those. And that's the current at Rock Island is Tom Mason and Jerry Hargrove at Rocky Reach. So I'm not done yet. So we're going to move on to the main building. So the main building down here at that time when I started wasn't three stories high. It was only two. It had a covered carport on one side, and there was no pavement down below. That was dirt. That was just dirt. It was an automobile repair place. There was Dairy Gold Milk was there. There's another couple of buildings. And then the bottom of the tech shop was Diddy's department store and grocery store as a warehouse, which I'm sure a lot of you folks probably remember from the day. And so I'm going to move on now. I'm going to move to Fleet Service. Fleet Service, the way it is today. And then it was half the length that it was. In fact, the dock going down from the warehouse to the Fleet Service there was where the transformer shop was. The dock at the distribution was twice the size of width as it was, because that's where all the transformers were. There was no Holly Street at that time. We had a railroad track that came through the back of the building, and when those big things came through, that's where they came. So I'm going to move on now. Almost done. The Holly Street Yard. Now, we all know where that is. It's behind Save Mart, and it's quite a big deal today. So at that time, there was just a couple of Quonset huts, maybe a couple of World War II buildings there. There was no fencing. There were just cross arms in those buildings and just stuff. So as far as where the fiber optics is at, there was a gully. So they had to fill in the gully first. Because down at the bottom of that gully was a bunch of mud, and that's where the large power poles were at. There was no Appalachia. Leavenworth office, where Dan's Market is there, the grocery store. If you went across the street behind the liquor store there without stopping at the liquor store, no. But anyway, it was a big old house with an upstairs, and that's where the office was, business office. And where the warehouse was and where the trucks that needed to go inside were, it was just dirt, rickety shelving, and there was no accountability for any of the parts in there. When they needed stuff, that's where it got done. There were no CSCs to make jobs the way they are today. And then they finally moved and decided to build the new building, and that's become quite an establishment now. And I was set up there for 2.5 more years to help get the warehouse up in Leavenworth set up. I think I got one more. Yes, I do. So the Chelan office. Now, I'm born and raised in Chelan, so I'm pretty proud of that, right? So the Chelan office, the original Chelan office, of course, was Puget Power. And the business office of that is located about 50 feet towards the old bridge from the Episcopal Church. And that's where the first business office was. Now, as far as the warehousing is, you would go up around towards Swim World. You'd take a right and go towards our little PUD park there. And before that, you'd see Kelly's Hardware's got a warehouse, another garage door. And inside that garage door, half of that garage door opening and the stuff inside was ours. Again, no accountability for it. This just stuff was brought in. So finally, they decided they wanted to modernize, and they wanted to make a new place. And so what they did is they bought the old Blair Pontiac building up past the Apple Cup. And that became what is now today the Chelan Service Building and Warehouse. Hmm. Now, as far as the utility poles, back when it started, they didn't have a fence, anything. So down at the baseball field, down by the Chelan Dam, They just put them on top of other poles and hope nobody would take them. Yeah, let me see if I got it. Oh, I got one more thing. So you'll like this. So we're pretty high tech now, right? Everything is high tech, and we got Maximo, and we had Reflections before that, which was a lot better than what we started with. What we started with was everything was pencils on 3-sheet carbons.
Right.
Everybody, if they ever worked during that time, it sounds like they remember it. Had to be all, we had a key punch operator that had to be key punched into the main stream one in the main building, and that's how things were run. Again, there were no CSE engineers to make the jobs. They're kind of made on the fly. The foreman went out the day before, and they decided what was going to happen, and then they came back and they got stuff. You don't have to think I'm out of gas, Randall.
Well, back in the day, it sounds like we had a lot of dirt everywhere. So 43.26 years and counting, you can probably figure that Terry's our go-to guy. So just have to share a little bit of humor with you. It happens probably once every 6 months. So we get a young apprentice or a young engineer, and negatively toward either one of those. They'll come into the warehouse and they'll say, Terry, we need to stock this. Terry will say, sit down. Let's talk about that. 30 years ago, that product came out and it was defective, so we didn't use it. 20 years ago, they modified it and we considered it, still didn't work. 10 years ago, we actually put it in stock and we used it. Then they changed it again 5 years ago and they went to plastic instead of metal and we stopped using it. So no, I'm not going to stock that. he's our go-to guy for history and today. And Terry and I have worked together for 13 years in the warehouse. We have a great staff. We have a lot of fun, get a lot of work done. And so 43.26 years and counting is incredible. And we're here to recognize you for that, Terry. So a big round of applause for Terry. Thank you. So today there is a recognition also for anyone that wants to come from 2:30 to 4 in the auditorium. There'll be cake and coffee, those type of things, and Terry will be available to tell you more stories about back in the day.
Awesome. I appreciated the history lesson today and things that I didn't know about. Also, two specific items for me. Realized that I started my career the same year you did in 1976. And the other connection that I found out that I have with Terry is his family lived in the Manson area. And as a superintendent of Manson, you realize there were no addresses on streets and things like that. It was the old Doc Hubbard's house and, you know, the McFadden area of town. And, well, I found out today that your family lived not far from where I lived in Manson, and now when I go by McFadden Road down there, I'll know what that means. So, thank you very much. At this time, commissioners, would you join me up here for a quick photograph?
That's you. That's you, buddy.
Where are we gonna go?
Just right
up front. Right up front.
Terry, are there people you'd like to introduce to everyone here?
I would. So, first of all, Jeff Hissern House. He works in Fleet. He's been a friend since he was in high school, pretty much. Next to him is my brother-in-law, Gary Roy. And same, I've chased him around the yard when he was a little kid, and now he chases me, I guess. So we got Andy behind there, my sister-in-law Becky McFadden, my brother Larry McFadden. He says he's the best-looking twin. I don't know. He said that several times today. My wife Cecilia McFadden, right next door to that, and my good friend John Adams right there. And my boss is a boss, Debbie Dan, in the back. And we got, we got a whole bunch of people. Where'd you guys come from? We got Cody. We got Scott. We got Carrie. We got Ripley. We got DeLozer. I've lost first name. All the time.
Back in the day.
Oh, Randall. Hi. Lauren, we got John. There's a whole bunch of them. Well, I sure appreciate you guys all coming. Means a lot to me. So here's the deal. 5 years ago, my wife said, Terry, work as long as you want. I'm doing just fine, because he retired from the Hospital Foundation, which is really a message to me that says I really don't need to have you under my feet. And so that's why you're stuck with me today, but less than 3 years. And then we've got some plans and a lot of things to do, and we'll do them.
Thanks for that. That was fun.
A lot of fun.
Okay.
I was a little shocked by this, but I was told that the group who was just here were not that interested in the plan of finance.
Sorry, Debbie.
Personally, I'm very excited about this presentation that we're going to be giving. So Heather Ireland and Debbie Litchfield will be presenting.
Good morning, commissioners. I think that's going to be a hard act to follow Terry there. I'm Debbie Litchfield, treasurer for the district, and with me is Heather Ireland, senior treasury analyst. And today we're here to continue the discussion that we had from the last meeting on the 2020 finance and some opportunities we have over the next few months to optimize our debt portfolio. So today's discussion is just going to be for information only. There's no action that will be required. The proposed plan includes three key actions. That include a component of refinancing, some debt payoff, and some new money as well. And the combination of these actions altogether will not materially change the debt outstanding, but it will provide us with some savings that will be generated through reduction of interest cost. And we expect that it will also have a neutral to positive impact to our financial metrics over the next 5 years. So with a little bit more of the detail on that, I will let Heather provide that.
Thanks, Debbie. Just wanted to touch back before we kind of get into the weeds, which is my favorite part, right? a little bit more higher level.
Yeah, it's legal, you know.
We also like to have a lot of fun.
Did I say that? I can't believe Debbie said that. Oh my.
She's also a hard act to follow. our debt philosophy here at the district. The board did affirm a debt philosophy a few years back, and really what we're trying to do is manage the district's debt to create that financial flexibility to support our low and stable electric rates, even if we have lower than expected financial results. And what we do to manage that debt philosophy is really a balancing act. It's trying to seek a balance between our cash and our debt to support that flexibility. And that changes over time. We're always adjusting and looking for what that right balance is. Years ago, we saw that we were a little out of balance. We really needed to bring that debt outstanding balance down. That was a priority for our customer owners. The board made it a priority for them. And we took those actions and figured out what is the most efficient way we can get that leverage, that debt outstanding balance down to help provide and support that additional financial flexibility for the district. We're transitioning now into more of a maintenance mode. We're looking for what is the best way we can maintain that balance and still preserve that flexibility to adjust over time. To do that, it really drives us looking at our debt portfolio and trying to come up with ways that we can optimize that portfolio. How can we create the most flexibility for the district at the lowest possible cost? And that's what we're looking at in the 2020 plan of finance, is generating some of that flexibility and cost savings. One of the great things about this is that if we lower our net interest costs, that improves our flexibility in a potential lower downside case. The lower the requirement of debt service that the district has to cover, that relieves pressure on rates because we don't have to rely on rates as much to cover those costs in each year. So the great thing about achieving this balance is there's some opportunity right now to do that at a lower cost with lower risks and preserve that flexibility for the district, which really supports the strategic priority two that the board just adopted in the district's new strategic plan to sustain excellent financial resiliency while mitigating the risk of large rate increases. So with that being the focus today, I wanted to anchor back to some of the long-term debt planning strategies that also go with that debt philosophy overall. This is a little bit more of the detailed things that we're going to be doing. Today, some of the areas that we've achieved some success on and we're continuing as we go forward is maintaining a liquidity balance of greater than $175 million or the policy minimum. And also maintaining a debt leverage ratio less than 35%. We achieved that last year, and we're continuing to forecast that we can meet those metrics. From a planning and forecasting standpoint, we're planning to borrow for long-term sustainability and not temporary challenges. That can really be seen in our financial forecasts, where we're projecting that in the future we'll be doing some modest future bond issuances to support a portion of our capital plan, using that combination of pay-as-we-go and also cash-funded capital. Planning to do those financings in 2 to 3 year increments for efficiency. It doesn't make a lot of sense, if possible, to do a bond issuance every year, although it's our favorite thing in the world. We know that it's not everyone's, and it takes a lot of time and effort to do a bond financing. So making sure that we plan for that and stagger those out over the future is really what we're trying to achieve. We also took some actions last year to implement some internal loans for the debt reduction and capital. We utilized debt reduction and capital recovery charges to fund the Rocky Reach and Rock Island capital plan to the extent available, but then also do some internal loans to support that capital activity when it's necessary. So with those actions, we have some additional long-term planning strategies which have some opportunities for us in 2020. So one of them is related to a comprehensive proactive plan of finance. Again, ongoing, every year we come back to the board to describe what are we planning on doing 1 year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. So we continue to do that to make sure we have the right balance of cash and debt. But in addition, we tried to, for planning purposes, plan to finance long-lived capital assets, things for modernization and expansion from debt proceeds, and continue to use cash financing for things that are more replacement-based capital. We also look to leverage market conditions. We're constantly monitoring refinancing opportunities and looking at the markets. Where are the opportunities for the district to reduce our costs? And with that comes managing to the lowest net interest. And lowest net interest is basically the difference between our interest expense less our interest earnings. We've seen improvement in those results over the years as we've been able to reduce our debt balances, and we want to ensure that we can continue to preserve and improve that where we can. The three proposed actions that Debbie mentioned at the kickoff here were: we have a combination of refinancing, some payoffs, and some new money really support these strategies of financing assets, long-lived assets, for the long term, and also managing to that lowest net interest expense. So let's get into the really interesting stuff, at least to us. Market conditions right now are favorable for looking at savings opportunities for our debt portfolio. I wanted to present an example of what borrowing rates looked like. The last time the district did a significant bond issuance was in 2011 versus what those debt rates have looked like in 2019. The black line is 2011, the blue line being 2019. The district has an investment portfolio where short-term interest rates most impact that portfolio. And that's because we're typically investing our funds in liquid cash and in midterm duration bonds and CDs. Those are things in kind of the 3-month, 2-year, 5-year range. Those are those shorter-term rates that really impact our investment portfolio. But the rates that really impact our debt portfolio is the longer-term rates, more in the 10-year and 20-year and even 30-year range, depending on how long we're issuing bonds. You can see that out in the 5, 10, and 30-year range, the last time the district issued bonds in 2011, that black line is much higher than the current blue line. The current market does offer opportunities for savings for our debt portfolio. Specifically, how we can take advantage of that is we can use a traditional refinancing mechanism. These bonds that we're proposing would be looked at for refinancing were issued over 10 years ago in that higher rate market. They're currently callable, and we have the opportunity to refund those from rates in the 4.5% to 5% range down to rates in the 1.5% to 3% range, depending on the duration of those bonds. It presents a savings opportunity for us. Based on current market environment, we believe we could achieve potentially $5 to $8 million of savings. That's over the life of the bonds. So the bonds have a remaining life on them of approximately 10 to 15 years. So it's not savings we get all at once, but it is a nice amount of savings we achieve over time. Some additional benefits to doing refinancing of these bonds would be we'd also streamline our debt portfolio so we have fewer outstanding liens. It would eliminate some exposure to federal budget sequestration. We've already experienced a little bit of a detriment because of that, but this would be prevent any future detriment. It would actually get the bonds out of that structure, so we wouldn't mitigate that risk. It also would allow for some slightly simplified administration, a little less disclosure, fewer tables in our annual report. So there's some administrative benefits in addition to the cost savings. This proposed action would be approximately $45 million of outstanding bonds that we would refinance. So we'd take higher rate bonds and be able to issue them in this lower rate environment. The second part of our proposed 2020 plan of finance actions would be to utilize some existing cash to pay off some higher rate bonds. As I just talked about, the current environment is favorable for borrowers because rates are so low. However, the district as an investor, it's not really favorable for us. We would prefer to have higher rates as an investor. So rather than paying a storage fee for our cash, we could instead pay off those higher rate bonds. Cash is certainly necessary for liquidity purposes. That's one of the reasons we've put in place that liquidity methodology that looks at what the district's operating, planning, and contingency reserve needs are. We would certainly never propose that the district would use 100% of their cash to pay off all of their debt. But there is an amount that's, if it's above what the district needs for liquidity purposes, it makes sense to look at it. Do we have higher cost bonds that we could retire? Not all bonds are retirable or refundable in current markets. That's why we haven't done this in the past. But taking actions in 2020 to minimize those gaps between our borrowing and investing rates makes sense. So this part of the proposed action would be to utilize approximately $85 million of lower yielding cash to retire higher rate bonds. However, one thing I want to point out is that the district is not in an active debt retirement mode. Again, we're in that maintenance mode of how can we maintain that balance between cash and debt as efficiently as possible. So the next part is where we get to the factor, as Debbie mentioned at the very beginning, that we're looking at maintaining approximately the same leverage balances, not actively drawing those down and reducing them. So this component is where we can use some proactive strategies to fund long-lived district capital assets using the most effective means possible. Some of the different things that dictate the cost of financing include the different structure that the bonds have, the duration of those bonds, tax advantages, and the interest rate environment. We talked about the interest rate environment being very favorable to the district right now. We also have some planned capital projects in the near term, 2020, 21, 22, that would qualify as projects for tax-exempt financing. And that advantage in most markets is that it costs us less to issue tax-exempt bonds than to issue taxable bonds. So utilizing these planned long-lived assets that could qualify for that tax-exempt treatment is a very efficient means of the district seeking external financing.
Heather?
Yes.
Is that not to exceed $70 million combined? Is that a limit we have on current authority?
No. So it's the amount that we're currently proposing as part of the plan of finance to maintain that approximately neutral leverage position. We do have slightly more authority if that was something that the board was interested in seeking financing for. But this is our current recommendation. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit about the timeline, too, to let you guys know that this is not a decision point. We have many months to work through this and make some additional decisions. We would propose that cap right now, at least in a resolution that we would be asking the board to potentially approve in December. And the reason for that is to preserve flexibility. That not to exceed $70 million that we would be asking for a resolution in December would be a cap for amounts that we would spend potentially in the next 6 months or so on these type of qualified tax-exempt projects. Certainly, the board would have another decision point later on to decide how much in bonds to issue. A couple of the components that go into that number is one of the assets that potentially would qualify for tax-exempt financing is a portion of the service center. The service center already has $50 million in board-designated funds set aside to fund a portion of that project. So that is one consideration. In addition, there are some projects in the distribution system itself for expansion and modernization, and primarily those would be things like substations and the automated metering infrastructure that would be good candidates, according to our debt philosophies and debt planning strategies, to be looked at for this type of financing. They're qualified tax-exempt projects, they're long-lived, they're expansion and modernization type assets rather than replacement. So this part of our proposal would be to borrow up to $70 million for a portion of long-lived assets in this low-rate environment. So how does this all roll together for the plan of finance in 2020? It would include three primary components: some refinancing of old outstanding bonds of about $45 million, some payoff of some old outstanding higher-rate bonds of about $85 million, and some new issuance to fund tax-qualified projects of about $70 million. When combined, all of these actions on the district's debt portfolio have the potential net present value savings of approximately 15% of the par value of the bonds that we'd be discussing, meaning about $10 to $15 million over time. And again, that's over the life of the bonds, probably about 10 to 15 years. It wouldn't be recognized all at once. As a rule of thumb, a lot of times public issuers, from a best practice standpoint, look at refinancing opportunities that provide somewhere in the 3 to 5% net present value savings range. So this 15% range is definitely within a best practice look. A few things that would impact that potential savings is obviously rate environment. In the current rate environment, we would have to see a more than doubling of rates to eliminate all of the potential savings. So even if rates climb over the next 2, 3, 4 months, there's still potential that the district could access some good savings. There would have to be a significant change in investment markets and debt markets to eliminate all of the savings. Again, the actions, when combined, align with our debt philosophy and planning strategies. We'd see reduction in reduced interest cost and risks, and we would have better long-term financial results for our customer owners, ultimately helping support that lower pressure on rates. In the expected case, we would see neutral to positive impact to our metrics over time, specifically in debt service coverage, which is one of those areas that definitely helps relieving rate pressure. Did want to note that these proposed actions are not included in the budget presentation that you guys will be seeing this afternoon. Because these are proposed and we don't have a board-approved action plan, we don't want to include those in the budget yet. If at a later date the board does approve this plan of finance, then we would work to incorporate those in future forecasting and budgeting. There is some detail about the changes in the district's metrics in the back of this presentation in the appendix, so you can see the proposed changes that would be on the metrics if this action did go into place. That's in comparison to the Q3 financial update that was provided 2 weeks ago. And those changes that you see, the potential changes of taking these actions, would be materially similar to what you would see to the budget.
Before you move on,
sure.
Next to the word liquidity, mm-hmm. Is DCOH.
Days cash on hand.
Okay.
Yes, it's a measure of how many days could the district operate with our regular operating expenses based on our unrestricted cash that we have. It is one of the district's financial metrics. Correct. Yep. But thank you for pointing out that was an acronym
there. I just
there.
Put the acronym together. I thought it was direct current on hand. Just wanted to make sure you were okay.
That's a good one, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Days cash on hand. If that was the impact that we would see potentially from this action in an expected case, we also want to look at what is the potential impact in an unusual case. Again, one of the goals of managing to our debt philosophy is to help the district be in a situation that we have financial flexibility if lower than expected results happen. And the great news about this proposed plan of finance is that because we're looking at lowering costs through lower interest rates, taking these actions has a positive impact in the unusual case as well. Again, supporting that financial flexibility and reducing rate pressure, even if lower financial results result, if lower than expected financial results are experienced, we'd have still that neutral to positive impact on liquidity, days cash on hand, debt leverage, and debt coverage. Again, specifically in debt coverage, that metric would be improved, which helps relieve rate pressure. So what would this look like? These numbers are all based on the expected case. Our 2020 operational plan of finance in 2020 would have us continue to make our scheduled principal payments of debt. In addition, we would have some early retirements of debt, which are mostly offset with new debt issuance, and we would also take some refinancing actions. At the end of 2020, fairly consistent with what our current forecast is, the district's par debt would be $404 million on a forecast basis and a 26% debt ratio. Over time, you can see that the district's par amount and debt ratio continues to decline in this expected case scenario. Really, that's a factor of the district doesn't intend to do early debt retirements, but we do have scheduled maturities. And as those scheduled maturities occur, those scheduled maturities are greater than the forecast amount of new debt issuance in the expected case. One of the great things about the district's current plan of finance and potentially the 2020 plan of finance is that we have a mitigation tool. If lower results are experienced, that we can issue bonds while still managing under that 35% debt ratio. This opportunity allows the district the flexibility to do that while mitigating rate pressure. So talking a little bit about timeline, what would it take to accomplish this 2020 plan of finance and these debt optimization actions? In December, I plan to come back to the board to ask for consideration of a reimbursement resolution for adoption. The reimbursement resolution is a very short resolution that basically states that the board intends at a future date to issue tax-exempt bonds to reimburse the district for funds that are spent on tax-exempt projects between the time that the resolution is adopted and the time the bonds are issued. It preserves the district's ability to finance spending in the next 2-3-4 month period on otherwise qualified projects and reimburse ourselves from the proceeds of those bonds. The great thing about a reimbursement resolution is it does not require us to issue bonds. It just preserves the flexibility to do so and still capture the benefit of funding at those tax-exempt qualified projects. Throughout Q1 of 2020, we continue to do evaluation and discussion in regards to doing a bond issuance. Behind the scenes, Treasury and Finance would also be doing planning and preparation, as well as requesting support from some other groups within the district to help produce a disclosure document that we might use if we do decide to issue bonds. That decision point, that kind of go, no-go decision, comes in early April, late March, right about the end of Q1. And really, that decision point is going to be dependent on our markets still favorable, first off. We probably would not propose moving forward with some of these actions if markets were no longer favorable. But if they are, does it make sense to the district to move forward? If so, we would recommend an adoption of a resolution to authorize the refinancing and issuance of bonds. That resolution would have a not-to-exceed bond issuance amount that could be greater or less than that original $70 million that's approved as part of the reimbursement resolution. Again, that reimbursement resolution is just preserving that flexibility in the next few months. We would also take action to pay off the higher rate bonds. And then in May, we would move forward with publishing our offering documents, which would include our 2019 financial results. And then the district would actually go to the market to market and sell our bonds. So at this time, I'd certainly like to answer any questions.
Well, it really isn't in the form of a question, but I'm sure that you remember well that I caught Kelly Boyd off guard 2 weeks ago in this conversation. And I am excited about what you're doing. In my tenure as a small businessman, I was at some level debt financing for over 40 years. And the value of what you are bringing to us right now and doing on a in my business, I probably refinance things just about every 10 years because conditions changed. And the value of what it brings to the organization, I just think is tremendous. And so I just want to say thank you for keeping your eye on the ball that you enjoy a lot. That's obvious.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about the potential that you're presenting to us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Heather, will you go to the appendix and the financial metrics?
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at liquidity, cash yes. on hand. And you said that this is reflected there where it says change from Q3 2019 financial update, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
So we see 108 in parentheses. So what that's telling us is that that's the change.
Yes. So this gives me the opportunity to talk a little bit more about the weeds. one of the actions that we're proposing to take is, again, as we were talking about our cash balance, it's really not a favorable time to be in the investment market, but it's a great time to be in the borrowing market. Mm-hmm. What we're proposing to do is utilize some of that liquid short-term cash in 2020 to retire maturities that we would otherwise be scheduled to pay in 2021 and 2022. So we would do a small amount of prepayment in those couple of years. We'd advance those couple of years. By 2022, we'd be in the same position that we otherwise would have been from a debt outstanding forecast, but we'd do it at a lower cost. So it would decrease our liquidity and our debt balance slightly beyond what our current forecast includes for 2020 and 2021. But by 2022, we'd be relatively in the same position. It's an additional way to achieve some savings.
Right. So that number, 108, mm-hmm. is reflected where in the numbers up above it?
So the plan of finance expected scenario mm-hmm. From this forecast would be we would end 2020 at 376 days cash on hand. The current Q3 forecast expected that we would have ended the 2020 year at 484 days cash.
Oh, okay, so it's pretty straightforward. That's what I thought.
So the results projected here would be what would be the results including this financing okay. action, and how is that different from what we showed you in Q3?
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
Great. Great job. Great explanation.
Heather, I really appreciate and believe in that three-legged stool of refinancing old debt, paying off old debt, and issuing new debt. In your time frame, so having done this myself in a different organization, timeliness is often really important. You want to hit those targets at the right time. Do you have the flexibility given that December mark and the timeline you have, that if you needed to jump in and move, particularly in a refinance situation, you can do that?
We think so. Just kind of some history. The district hasn't issued a lot of bonds recently, mm-hmm. But we went through an exercise to kind of look back through history, and since Debbie's been at the district, I think you said 49 different issues.
And over $1 billion
in
issuance. So,
and I've participated in about half of those. In 2008, we actually did a bond issue in 6 weeks. It was a little abnormal, to say the least, during that time frame. But we believe we do have not only the internal team in place, but also the external financing team that we work with in place. We've also reached out to internal stakeholders here at the district to kind of make them aware of what our intended time frame was. What we do depend on others at the district for is their input into, I didn't bring a copy with me, the book, the official statement that we release, which basically is intended to describe what is the district's business and what are our risks to a potential investor. And that, updating that document does take a little bit of effort and work, and we haven't updated that document in about 5 years. So that actually is one of the biggest, will be one of the biggest time constraints. But even if there was a situation where our finance team and both internal and external saw that we did need to get to market, we believe that we have the capacity and skill to do that.
To add a couple things to that, one of the things that we're looking to do is to leverage the completion of our 2019 audited financials and be able to use that audited information in the marketing of the bonds. It really just kind of simplifies the process if we can leverage that. The other thing is that while the current projections are markets will maintain kind of this steady low level, that can always change. But current expectation is that the low interest rates will continue for some time. So that's why at this point we feel very confident that the timeline that we have here will work well with working with the internal stakeholders, the internal folks at the district that helped provide the information related to the official statement, our marketing document, and also being able to still capture that great benefit that we're currently seeing in the market. But certainly we can move faster if we need to.
One final question. Back to the, excuse me, one of the initial questions I had for you. It seems like it would be appropriate at moving forward that we do everything in our power to maximize in our portfolio the amount that is tax exempt.
Yes.
And that's why I was asking if we'd hit the limit with that $70 million, and I didn't know. And so I don't know what subsequent years will look like, but it just seems like, however that works.
Mm-hmm. And we do have the really great thing about the position the district currently is in is we do have some time to continue to do that. So when we typically borrow, and for tax-exempt purposes, what we're required to do is we're required to borrow for what we reasonably believe we can expend within no more than a three-year period. So unfortunately, we can't go to the market and say, let's go ahead and borrow everything that we think we're going to need to spend in the next 10 years for tax-exempt projects. One, we'd be paying interest on that all along, but also the tax laws won't allow us to. But because of the ability to utilize reimbursement resolutions, we have some rolling time that we can continue to make those decisions. So even if the district chose to borrow $70 million in 2020 to pay for tax-exempt projects, if we saw a need in 2021 or 2022 that we would like to continue to utilize that authority to borrow, we can come back to the board and do a new reimbursement resolution to preserve that authority and not forego that as a missed opportunity. It also would align potentially with the next time the district is forecasting to be in the market for new bond financing. Right now, our forecasts include that in about 2022. So this actually would also align with our kind of every 2 to 3 year bond issuance for efficiency purposes. So we think we have the ability to preserve that capacity and not forego that.
So will our public have access to purchasing these bonds?
The bonds will be offered publicly.
Publicly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we typically do an outreach process where we make sure that local brokers have the information about the upcoming bond issuance so they can connect with their clients.
Yeah. I've had a phone call from a local person who has some money they'd like to invest, and they'd like to do it through Chelan County PUD, and I've been in contact with Kelly on that. So.
Good.
Hence the question.
Anything else? Thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very informative.
And it wasn't boring.
Not a bit.
No.
Hopefully we met Commissioner Smith's expectations.
Well, no, it's pretty exciting, really.
Okay, we're moving on to item number 6.
This is conservation targets for 2020 and 2021. Andrew Cassell presenting. Recall that we are required under I-937 to review this every 2 years. That's what we'll be doing today.
Good morning. Andrew Grissel, Customer Energy Solutions. And it is that time in our planning cycle to develop a conservation potential assessment in order to set our 10-year plan and our 2-year compliance target. So today's meeting is informational. Both the law and the implementing rules outline steps required to both set the target as well as communicate results to our stakeholders and allow them opportunity for input. These steps were followed, and in 2 weeks I'll be back formally to recommend the adoption of the 10-year plan and 2-year target that we'll be presenting here. So the conservation potential assessment was developed by a third party. This was EES Consulting. And really the primary purpose of this is to update all the data that we have available to figure out what it is that we can do over the next 10 years. Major drivers include avoided costs, which for us are things like the energy market prices, carbon prices, capacity prices. It's also important to update the amount of savings a particular measure can provide to us, and so these are being looked at all the time, and those savings measures changes, and so all that data needs to be taken into account. And then per the statute, we need to be consistent with the Northwest Power and Conservation Council's methodology, and this was done. The CPA was our CPA provided a 10-year potential for the 2020 to 2029 time period. This graph, our chart, shows where those changes have occurred and what that total number is. Over the time period between the last potential assessment and this one, we have increased the total amount by about 4 average megawatts. And we're seeing really big changes in both the residential and the industrial sector. And in the following slide, I'll discuss that a little bit further. So the major drivers of the potential assessment, within the residential sector, we have water heating and HVAC. And underneath those particular areas, there are a number of measures that have driven this. On the commercial industrial sector, we have low and medium temperature refrigeration, as well as energy management. So for water heating, we have an increase. We're looking at increasing the incentives for the heat pump water heater program. We are looking at how to incorporate low flow showerheads into our programs. One idea is we're doing a lot of audits with going out to customers' houses, doing audits for them. Maybe taking showerheads out with us at that point would be a good way to do that. We're also looking at, in the HVAC, duct sealing. A few years ago, we did a very intensive manufactured home duct sealing program where we hit the majority of those manufactured homes. This is for the stick-built homes and what we'll need to do to overcome or to take advantage of the savings that are here is to identify a local contractor who'd be willing to do a program for us, and we're in the process of looking at that now. And of course, we'll have residential weatherization, and the weatherization we're looking at increasing specifically for homes with single pane windows or with no insulation that are also electric furnace heated. Right now, our weatherization program kind of melds everything together, so we just have one program, same incentive for all of them, that that's easier to administer. In order to really hit these savings, we're going to start focusing on those homes that meet that criteria. That's where we get the bigger savings, and that's also an area where that'll provide the most comfort for the customers that are there, because they'll have these homes that have single panes, no insulation, drafty, and so we're trying to really dig into that market. On the industrial sector, of course, we have the food storage for low to mid temperature refrigeration. This is compressors, motors, looking at ways we can help help our industrial customers with their processes. The big one we're going to really focus on this year is energy management, and you'll hear us call it strategic energy management. This is where we go and we look first for low to no cost actions that can be taken to help save energy. A lot of times the companies have already done some capital improvement processes and projects, and so we go in there and model their usage, their processes, and figure out where can we help them tweak their operations to take the most advantage out of those capital projects that have already been installed. While at the same time, it's also looking at, are there additional capital projects that we could help them fund? And so it's really looking at it from those two areas. And of course, there is still some lighting available, although because of codes and standards at the national level and at the state level, this is going to continue to become smaller. Historically, it's been a fairly large area of savings for us. We're going to see a continual decline on this one. And this slide shows us our savings over the last 10 years. We've acquired almost 20 average megawatts in savings, and in almost every year, you'll see that we have acquired more savings than our compliance target. The dotted lines of compliance target bars are what we've actually saved. And for 2020 to 2021 period, where the potential assessment identifies about 2.82 average megawatts over that two-year time period, we're going to, and I'll show you a little in the next slide, we're going to target 2 average megawatts in each of those years for our stretch goal at this point in time. This provides a comparison of our 2018 and 19 targets with the projected 2020 to 2021 targets. And so what you do see is that our expenditures are increasing over time. This is due to a combination of low-cost lighting going away and higher avoided costs, leading to our ability to pay for higher incentives to help drive some of those savings. We are, as I mentioned earlier, we are targeting a stretch goal of 2 average megawatts, and then we expect more to pay for this on a megawatt-hour basis. However, these prices are still extremely cost-effective when you look at them compared with other resources that are available out there. So in summary, we developed a CPA consistent with our laws and regulations. We updated information for the CPA, and this included our provided us with a higher target to look at, included higher voided cost market prices. As expected, the costs are increasing, but we do see these, even with these increased costs, we're seeing a great cost-effective test. And then finally, I'll be back in 2 weeks to formally recommend the two-year target and the 10-year plan for your consideration. Open that up to any questions. Okay.
Well, Andrew knows I've got a few questions. I made him nervous earlier this morning, and I think he was prepped by the general manager. just to start up, not a question as much as this past October, I went back to Washington, D.C. for the Legislative Energy Horizon Institute. And it was a big picture look at what is driving our energy system here in the United States. And one of the things that I came away from that seminar with a great new appreciation for was the value of conservation and energy efficiency. Hadn't thought of it in these terms before, but as we go through our cycle here in the Northwest of carbon reduction, everybody starts looking for, a renewed look for what's going to provide the capacity for us to keep the lights on. And wind and solar are intermittent power sources. We all know that. Energy conservation is like an increase in energy capacity. Because, for the most part, there are peak moments right. and others, but it has less fluctuation than wind and solar in terms of what you get from energy conservation. And so I really did come back with a greatly enhanced view of the value of conservation and efficiency. And it prompted a lot of questions that I directed to our general manager in some off times, and wondering how far ultimately can we get with energy conservation here in Chelan County? Have we gone very far beyond the low-hanging fruit in what we're attempting to achieve here in Chelan County? And I recognize also that the people of Chelan County, once they utilize what we've presented to them, really appreciate that. So that, I guess that the question that I tee up right now is, how much more is really out there?
That's a good question, and that's one that we're always looking at to see, because obviously our potential assessments provide us with a number, and then as you've seen, we've been able to take some of those savings from the outward years and move them closer to the time period with which we are actually operating within to gather more savings. And we do that through, you know, offering higher incentives. We do that through in our model, we have a model that provides us with a look at the value to the district. And within that model, it includes things like time of use, to where which measures are better and which measures are worse. And so we're taking into account that capacity sort of discussion within that as well. And so the number of how much is out there left, I think maybe from that 10-year perspective, it shows, you know, from a 10-year period, we've got 16 average megawatts. How much can, you know, if we're looking to do more faster, how much can we squeeze into those earlier years? And then when we do that, you know, that's, of course, you know, it leads to other things, such as we've got other programs we've got going on, people and all those sorts of things. So I think we're doing almost with what we have, we're almost doing we're very close to where we can get to on an annual basis with the, as far as what we're achieving. I think we continue to look for ways for more efficient projects. That's why how the strategic energy management came into being. You know, guy, there's got to be more ways to squeeze more energy than just putting a piece of equipment in. That takes time. It takes modeling effort and all those sorts of things. But those are things that we're doing. it's also, you know, working with our customers as well. You know, how much effort do we make with each of our customers? But it's something we look at, and it's something that we're continuing to look at even into this next year. We have plans to how much can we drive our low income? Can we do better with our low income? Right now, we have one program that's a grant that the commissioners have provided to us starting, you know, many years ago that we provide to the Community Action Council. Is there more to do? We're doing some work this year to understand how much further can we drive that into those low and moderate income groups, all the way back on to the big industrial users. You know, how much can we drive with them through doing these studies with them and engaging with them? So I think there's an opportunity there for us to do more. I think we need to continue, though, understanding just what it is. You know, I don't know if that helps you at all. Yeah. Or
well, and the only other part of that I just wonder about is how great is our customers' true awareness of what's available and
right.
What's out there. That's always a question.
That is, and we do, you know, every year when we do our other surveys, other customer surveys, we generally try to put a question in like that: are you aware of our programs? I know several years ago we had a very, you know, we had a big difference between, say, our Latino Hispanic customers and you know, our Caucasian customers, because we weren't doing a good job with communicating to them. We've done a big effort there. Those numbers have coming up. I don't have them off the top of my head, but those numbers have come up. Every year, when we do these studies, we do a lot of marketing, and we try to figure out the best ways to communicate with people. And we're always seeing the numbers over time have come up. They're not obviously to where we need to get them or where we always want to have them. We're always trying to get better at that. But, you know, we do have some of those metrics out there of what customers are seeing and how many know of our programs and what do they think of our programs. So, and that's helped us drive to where we need to go.
Just so you know, you've got a new cheerleader out.
Well, I appreciate, you know, my team appreciates that, and I appreciate that, and we work really hard. I know we've done some benchmarking with other utilities, and you know, our staff generally does about 3 programs per FTE. That's a ratio of how many programs you have and how many FTEs you have operating them. The other utilities that were in that study, you know, they were in 1.5 to under 1. And so our team is very efficient. They work really hard, and we are always continuing to look at ways we can cost effectively bring those savings to our customers and to the utility.
I would just say, I think as part of the strategic plan, we have a commitment to come back mm-hmm. to you next year on the low-income energy efficiency
yes.
program. So that is already being developed and put into the performance plan for 2020. So you can count on that coming up. We haven't quite decided when that'll be coming up, but it will be in 2020 at some point.
It's going to be our first one of our first projects in Q1 that we're kicking off as far as the work to be done.
So. Great. Thank you, Andrew. Yep. Anything else? All right. Moving on to our annual review of fees and charges.
Yeah, I want to invite Kathy Melton to come up and join us. And Katie Marshall.
Good morning, commissioners. I'm Kathy Melton, customer service program analyst, and joining me today is Katie Marshall, our pole attachment program manager. And we're conducting the annual fees and charges review. So just as a reminder today, there's no action asked of you. That authority to make alterations to our fees and charges was granted over to our general manager in 2007 through that resolution. But this is providing you an update on some changes to come. So the first section that we're going to be looking at today are our electric service connection fees. And these are a blended average cost for new connections by our customers that include the transformer and the meter costs. And similar to what we attempted last year, this is going to be a 10% increase on the customer charges. Again, trying to strive towards closing that gap on cost recovery. It's always a delicate balance that we strive with this because we do have a continued increase in costs that we're facing from materials and also labor. But then also we're trying to mitigate and be cognizant of the impacts that going a full swing of that cost recovery change could have on our customers. So we're trying to balance that out. These will be continued to be looked at throughout the year. And we may come up with some alternative methods, but that will be updates that will come in a later presentation.
Kathy, you might want to just emphasize that this is a continuation of a previous program to move towards full cost recovery.
Correct. Yes, this is a continuation. Last year was the first time, I believe, in about 4 or 5 years that we had made alterations to the service connection fees. And so, again, we're taking those steps and trying to get there to close that gap. Then we had some additional electric service charges that we looked at as well. Main drivers on these charges include, again, those material and labor cost increases that we're looking at. And the secondary service pole was really the only exception of that. It did have a greater than a 10% increase on that, but it is still not recognizing the full material increase that the district is seeing on that as far as materials.
What is a hand hole?
I'm not the right person to answer that. I would have to look at our crowd and see if perhaps someone can answer that for you. I think it's one of the little green boxes that shows up in the ground out there, but I'm not sure.
The answer is coming up.
Okay, good.
John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Two. It's very close, yeah. Those little green boxes that's out there. Essentially, when we connect up from a transformer, we have multiple services going out to feed a premise or a home. So, yeah, it's a little junction box. It sits in the ground.
So, John, while you're there, secondary service pole.
Again, that's so when we come off from the transformer, envision an overhead power pole, and maybe it's a outbuilding or a home that's maybe a couple hundred yards off that right-of-way. So then there's another pole that's placed to just continue with the secondary wire.
Thank you.
Thank you. John Stoll to the rescue on that one. Much appreciated. Okay, so that was all that I had as far as my updates today. These changes will be going into effect January 1, and then we will perform similar outreach that we did with some of our customers last year. If they have quoted service connection fees that are yet to be paid, we'll give them a window of opportunity to honor those quoted fees before they would have to pay any adjustment.
What kind of a window?
I believe we gave them like a 90-day window the last time that we went through this. And that included some web updates to our landing pages on our external web page, in addition to a notice being sent to them, kind of reminding them that they had this quote out there lingering. And if they wanted to pay that at that level, now is the time. Beyond that, it would be requoted and adjusted to reflect the fees in place at that time.
And just a reminder, this is just the connection fees. So the issue that we've dealt with somewhat in strategic planning of what about if you have load growth, you have new substations and other needs that are out there, and trying to equalize that cost, because the new cost is, the marginal cost is higher than the average system cost. That's one that we still have outstanding. Maybe in 2020 we'll be able to get to that.
So I'm here to speak about the pole attachment rate update portion of this. And so last year, I don't know if you recall, I was up here a few times in 2018 and speaking about the effort that we had launched to reevaluate pole attachment rates, which are also focused on cost recovery, but more so in sharing the cost of poles and the operations and maintenance of poles with third parties that are attaching communication attachments to poles. So as part of that effort, we were making sure that the methodology aligned with the current state statute on how you have to calculate those rates, making sure that the inputs reflect what our current costs are that go into that, and making sure that any of the discretionary elements of that calculation aligned with what our current practices are. And so as a result of that calculation, we came up with a proposed rate of $29.89 per pole per year. But at the time this calculation was performed, there are components of that that were still the subject of appeal that was open in the Pacific PUD lawsuit. And so they were still some pieces of that calculation that had not been ruled on by the Court of Appeals. With that in mind, the rate we brought forward in September of last year and recommended was an interim rate of 23.14 that basically neutralized some of those components that were still the subject of appeal, and then saying that we would come back around and revisit once that case had finished. So they have finally wrapped up the Pacific PUD case. I think September 3rd of this year, they finally...
Yeah, we heard about it.
Yeah, the case heard around, at least the state, right? With that in mind, there was one component that the Court of Appeals clarified that we had to go and update in our original calculation. The RCW that talks about how you have to calculate these rates is this three-part, fairly convoluted equation. And so one of those pieces of the equation, the Court of Appeals clarified that the denominator used should be the whole height of a pole versus just the amount of space used on a pole. And so that took that $29.89 down to $27 per pole per year. And so that is the rate that we're bringing forward with fees and charges this year now that that suit is done and has been adjusted for the outcome of that. This new rate would be effective in the second billing of 2020. So pole attachments are billed twice a year. But our current agreements require us to have advance notice with them of 6 months. And so this rate wouldn't be effective until the second billing of next year. A lot of info and any questions on any of that?
Good to see it finally settled.
Yeah, no kidding.
For everybody.
Over a decade.
Yeah.
So completely off the wall question that you may not have the answer to and John may not off the top of his head. How many poles do we have in Chelan County?
Just including transmission, just shy of 30,000.
30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I would say about two-thirds of those at least have communication attachments on them.
I dare you to try to find a question she can't answer.
Should I run now?
Thank you.
Okay. Any questions on anything before we're done? Ooh. Don't do it with the left hand.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we've hit the end of the morning study session agenda items, but we do have time, and we have folks in the room who could address at least some, if not all, of the manager items that we had scheduled. With your approval, we'd move into that.
I would like to be finished at 11:45.
Okay.
For lunch.
Okay.
It's turkey day.
It's turkey.
That's our priority straight.
We can do that. We will move through these items quickly. Let me invite...
I'm sorry. I was trying to jump in there without interrupting. So I just have something I want to share about a conference I went to, and I want to do it when there are women in the room because it's something exciting for women. So I don't know if we're going to lose all these women this afternoon. If we do, then I'll be out of luck. So I don't know how you want to deal with that.
So Ann, would you go ahead and share that as our next group is coming up to get ready?
Thank you very much. So I attended the Women in Public Power Conference last week. It was in Portland, and I have to say it was in my top three conferences I've ever been to. It was absolutely fantastic. This is the third year. After the first year, they sell out every year. There were 150 women, and there were two men. Two brave men. Actually, there were more than two men because they did a panel. But I am putting it in a plug with Steve and with all of you women to consider it for next year. I tried to go the last 2 years and something came up, so I couldn't make it. But it's really, it was great for policymakers. It's even better for staff, for managers, for supervisors, for technical people. And men are invited. I'm not sure you want to come with 150 women, but I want to assure you that it's not just a lot of touchy-feely stuff. It's, in fact, well, let me just share quickly some of the keynote speakers. Number one was Cheryl Strayed, who wrote the book Wild. I see you shaking your head. Terrific book. That book probably, from what I've heard, that book probably increased the exposure or the use of the Pacific Crest Trail by 1,000%. And she was our first speaker, and she was just as good, you know, as a public speaker as she was in her book. She had tremendous struggles, if you remember her story, and, you know, just great advice and great insight on, you know, how do you keep going? How do you keep going? Then next up was, and I didn't know I was going to do it this morning. I didn't bring it with me, but I think it was Dr. Ginny Witt or Dr. Witt. Anyway, I have it. I have her name. She's a rocket scientist. She's a PhD. She's also a Zen master. She has a black belt in something. And she's now doing work with all kinds of different people on personality profiles and working with. And we did some work before we attended. We filled out, you know how you take the, what's the BRICS?
Myers-Briggs.
Right, right. It was similar to that, only different in a really good way. And so we did that, you know, preliminary to going. And then she presented the report to us. And she was so dynamic, so fun, so helpful. It was interactive. We jumped up. We moved around. And then third was Hillary. And I can't remember Hillary's last name. Hillary's an actor. These gals are from, Hillary's from, I don't know, on the East. They both live on the East Coast. I don't know how we pulled this off and got these great women. Hillary's an actor. She's a voice coach. She's done a lot of different things. And she was so phenomenal, so good. Just... the industry is a male-dominated industry, and that's changing, and it's not really that, that's not the case here at Schlen PUD, but it truly is a male-dominated industry, so there are a lot of awkward moments, and her program was owning the awkward, and, you know, we did a lot of role-playing and a lot of just, you know, terrific advice and helpful situations when you are in an awkward situation, especially publicly. There were great panels. Panels to me usually, oftentimes, I shouldn't say usually, are pretty boring. The panels were terrific. So anyway, I'm just plugging it for next year. I'll be aware of it. I'm looking to Steve. Maybe you can help me with, you know, talking to some of the women in our PUD and encourage them to attend.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity to go.
Reminds me as an elementary principal in 76 with going to a conference with two men and all women. So. Know that feeling. Thank you.
Thank you for letting me do that.
Yeah.
First up, I want to invite Michelle Smith to talk a little bit about the Horan Natural Area.
Thank you, Steve. Well, the public has made it very clear just how much they value and really care about the Horan area. I wanted to share with you that on November 6th for our open house, we had over 55 people attend that day. Within the first week of our online survey going live, which was the middle of October, we had over 90 responses. And then as of today, that's still available on our website, that survey, and we have over 200 responses. Mm. I personally have received over 20 letters from persons, organizations, and groups responding to our request for feedback. So we're listening. The community is giving us a lot of feedback. And so I'm here today to provide you with a quick summary of the survey results and how we plan to move forward. I wanted to bring up the website so that you could see what our public is seeing and how this is being used. We are basically still taking surveys online. I plan to keep this up indefinitely. I think as we continue to work through what we're calling influencing factors for, you know, Confluence Parkway project being underway. We have the city's also working on some stormwater projects and trying to decide the best way to master plan water going into the Horan area. I think it's good to keep that survey live and allow us to continue to get feedback. We also have a fact sheet that you can click on here that gives all background of ownership, history, some resource areas that are important to the area all on that fact sheet. Our communications department has done a really nice job of saying, well, here's what we're hearing so far. So the first question we asked are basically, how are people using the area? No surprise, things like walking and bird viewing and using it for nature trail education, all of those things are on there. By the way, the bigger the word, the letters, the more responses in that area. What do people value about the area? And we thought this was really important because as we look at sustainability and where we're going in the future, we wanted to know what the values were from our community perspective. And so, again, probably not a huge surprise, but we do have, again, wildlife, how quiet it is, the ability to observe nature, the serenity, bird watching, walking, you know, using it for education. And then how often do you visit? We had a number of, you know, across the board here, but it's getting used a lot. And anybody that's been in there, you often see people going in there. I think that wasn't a surprise either, that it's pretty much from daily to a couple times a year. And from the data summary, this is information that you can click on. And what we are doing is we are taking the results and we're categorizing them. So this kind of gets into our next steps. What we're planning to do, and I wanted to share this today, our next steps are really to come up with four deliverables. And our first one is we'd like to know what we can do in a manner of updating and our operating and management policies and actions. So right now there are certain things that we're doing to operate and maintain that area that have been ongoing since the 80s. And so if there's some things that we can do to improve the experience and just from a purely a maintenance or an operation perspective, we're going to take that into consideration and start looking at that in 2020 to maybe make some changes there. We're also, another plan here is to collect all these ideas and recommendations and help us engage on the city's projects, as I mentioned earlier, for the Confluence Parkway environmental analysis process they're going through, and then also as they develop their master plan for the stormwater outfall projects that they're working on. A third a deliverable that I'm envisioning here is really a draft management plan for the area that will take us into the future. And this is really an early relicensing action that we'd be doing for the Rock Island project. And when I say early action, I'm primarily meaning that we're collecting a lot of information and a lot of insight to the area that we would be normally doing this during the relicensing process. We're doing this a little bit early, but we'll have a great foundation and a draft concept for that area that will really kick us into relicensing a little bit early because we'll have a lot of the foundation already done. So I'm envisioning that we'll have what I'm calling a draft management plan for the area completed so that can be finalized as we walk into relicensing. And the fourth element that I see as a deliverable here is really just the contacts and the ongoing process we're going to have in place to continue to collect public feedback and input and a way for us to engage with a community that's transparent and open and just, you know, continuing to walk through this through our surveys, the website, meetings, and, you know, we're in particular going to be engaging and have a huge responsibility for that area that's been entrusted to us, I think, as especially with the Confluence Parkway project. That will have potential to run adjacent, current design is to run adjacent to that area. And I want to make sure that the district is upholding our responsibility for maintaining what the values and what our customer owners are telling us they would like to see in the future, that we're providing good input, you know, input to the city, and that we have a responsive way to our public to address those concerns. So if we're going to keep this updated online so people can go in and continue to see what the responses are. And we also have on here the letters that I've received. So the 20 plus letters that I've received are all on here. So anybody can go on into this site and see those letters that we're receiving. So I just wanted to summarize that the Horan area belongs to the public. It's our community. It belongs to our community. And its preservation has been entrusted to us. We think it's time to act now and use public processes, and together continue to shape the future of that area.
Thank you.
Nice.
Resident
moose? Is our moose still there?
Yeah, the moose.
The important thing. Yeah. The moose, looking at Kimberly.
The moose is still there.
It was as of Friday. They were.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I thought the description of what to look for in anticipating a moose charging.
Yeah, that was good.
Pretty interesting. And do not play dead.
Right. You will.
Yeah.
Thank you, Michelle. I'd like to slip in one more if we can. I think I want to invite Bill Towie to come up about the Northern Pike, not Northern Pike Minnow, the Northern Pike program.
Ooh, I didn't know there was a difference.
A big difference.
Mm.
Oh, yeah.
Holy smokes.
That's quite a picture.
Oh.
Good morning. You may have read or heard about it in the news or on the radio about the northern pike invasion in Lake Roosevelt. So what's the big concern? Why all the attention to northern pike? So as you can see, the northern pike is a fairly large predator, very aggressive. You can see the size of the salmonid in its mouth. It's a pretty large fish. They can eat up to 3/4 of their body length. So that gives you an idea of how aggressive they are and what they're capable of eating. So they've been known to eat bats, ducks, ducklings. So really anything they can get a hold of. They have burst speeds up to 10 miles an hour. So they're a fish that can lay in the bushes, so to speak, and wait for the prey to come by, and then they have these burst speeds of 10 miles. So really, if they want to go after something, they're pretty successful. So they eat lots of fish. So where are they at? So this map gives you a good representation of where the northern pike currently are detected. So this is Grand Coulee Dam.
Bill, you have to hold the mic up to your...
Sorry.
Thank you.
So the reservoir, Grand Coulee... Lake Roosevelt is 150 miles in length, and just to give you a reference, this is the Spokane River, the San Poil River, its major tributaries to that, to Lake Roosevelt. So that 150-mile reservoir, they're currently 10 miles from Grand Coulee Dam. So if you look at the distance to where they'll start in the anadromous, so salmon and steelhead zone. They go through Rufus Woods Reservoir, which is 50 miles. So you're looking at 60 miles separates us from this aggressive predator. And then, of course, when they get below Chief Joseph Dam, then we have 30 miles before they get into our project areas. So we're looking at less than 100 miles that these fish are knocking on the door. So I'll give you a quick update. I know we're running up against turkey time. I'll give you an update on our efforts to combat the invasive northern pike and answer any questions that you might have. First, I'd like to show you a great video that was produced by the Washington State Invasive Species Council. The video highlights the collaborative suppression efforts that are occurring in Lake Roosevelt. The video also touches on the importance of education and outreach. And that, the education and outreach is a tool for early detection of northern pike as they make their way down the Columbia River. Chelan PUD is actively involved in the collaborative suppression efforts and the education outreach, which I'll talk about after the video.
So if we could.
My name is Justin Bush, and I'm the executive coordinator of the Washington Invasive Species Council. The council was created by the state legislature for the purpose of working across organizations toward common goals to stop the spread of invasive species and prevent the introduction of ones that are not yet here. Of the species that we've looked at as a state, northern pike are one of the worst species that are currently in Washington. And I'm here today at Lake Roosevelt on the front lines of the effort to stop the spread of northern pike in the Columbia River Basin. For the first time, a lot of different organizations are coming together for the purpose of stopping northern pike collaboratively. The Colville Confederated Tribes, the Spokane Tribe of Indians, and the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife are working together. Additionally, with assistance from the Kalispell Tribe of Indians, as well as Grant Public Utility District and Chelan Public Utility District. All these different entities are supplying people, resources, equipment, and their time to work together to stop northern pike here in Lake Roosevelt.
Remnants of a rainbow trout.
We know how to stop northern pike, but we need your help. There are a few things that you can do to help us out. The first thing is not to move live fish from one water body to another under any circumstance. Secondly, be familiar with northern pike. Know how to spot it if you reel one in. And if you do reel one in, remember to retain it, don't let it go, and to report it to the Washington Invasive Species Council. We certainly want to know about any new locations within Lake Roosevelt where they've been found. But if you find one below Grand Coulee Dam and report it, you may be reporting the very first or second fish to make it to that area. And the subsequent response could save millions, if not billions, in economic impacts and environmental impacts. The last thing that everyone should note is if you're fishing in Lake Roosevelt, the Colville Confederated Tribes has a bounty program for northern pike. So if you're angling for northern pike and you catch one, if you remove the head, you can turn that into the Colville Tribes and get $10. And so there's three different ways that anyone can help, and we really appreciate your assistance in protecting the salmon and the steelhead of Washington State.
So that particular video was shot during a week in May that was referred to as all hands on deck. So all the agencies that Justin referred to converged on Lake Roosevelt. We set 475 nets that week and removed 439 pike from the population. Between 2015 and 2019, 10,500 pike have been removed from Lake Roosevelt. As Justin points out in the video, the importance of education and outreach, as the pike move downstream, we will rely on that information as an early detection tool. Brochures, radio spots, blogs, stickers, and other media outlets have been used to get the word out. We have installed informational signage at our boat launches to get the word out and so that anglers will familiarize themselves with the northern pike. If the northern pike are detected in our project waters, we will include them in our HCP predator removal program, similar to our efforts with northern pike minnow. Our prepared crews will be able to launch their experiences gained in Lake Roosevelt to removing northern pike in our project areas. Moving forward, we will continue to work with the partners in the Upper Columbia, and we'll provide you with updates with any new developments that happen. I'll be happy to answer questions. I brought some stickers and brochures that the Washington Invasive Species Council has produced, and we've worked with them pretty closely on the information that's contained in the brochures. So I'll hand that out and would be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
How were they introduced?
They were introduced in the 50s in Montana, and they've worked their way through the Clark Fork Pendere system into the Columbia.
Hmm. And sports fishermen love them because they put up a fight.
Mm-hmm. Mm, well, that's not good.
Huh? Thank you.
With that, we're done. All right. So we're adjourned, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock.
So,
Okay, we're reconvening for our business session this afternoon, and we will begin with our consent agenda.
I think we have a public hearing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I goofed
up. No, I just told him that. So let's just be clear about where the mistake is. So we do have the public hearing first,
okay,
until we go to the consent agenda.
Good. So we'll begin there.
Okay. I want to invite Craig Kuntz to come up and talk about the 2020 budget. This is an update, so we're trying not to repeat information that was provided at the last board meeting.
Thank you, Steve. Good afternoon, commissioners. This is the second public hearing on our 2020 budget. There is no board action required today. I am Craig Kuntz, the manager of strategic financial planning. The last presentation on November 4th, we had a lot more detail here. So this is really just Steve mentioned, this is just basically a brief description of what has changed. There's a lot more information consistent with the November 4th presentation in the appendix for your enjoyment. There's really one major item that's comprised of two changes. We did increase our net capital spending for 2020 budget by about $18.5 million from the November 4th presentation. I alluded to that November 4th, particularly in regards to the Rock Island B5 modernization as they were working on their scheduling. That was really an acceleration of costs from future that were out in the outer years to 2020 as they continue to refine their plans. So that was an increase of $15.8 million approximately. There was no change to that overall total project cost. That was simply an acceleration. And the Rock Island facilities upgrade increase, I will note that this number will change a little bit, and that is part of your consent agenda on November 11th. I'm going to talk about that in a couple more slides. That's actually going to go down just a slight, $122,000. But you heard the discussion from Sam Daly last November 4th about the work on the storage facility. So this was pretty much expect it, and it's just been modified just even further since this presentation was put together, and I'll highlight that a little bit later. And then from a bottom line net income perspective, it did increase about $0.8 million from $57.3 million on the November 4th presentation to $58.1 million. Again, we're always continuing to fine-tune our numbers, and now it's just really just fine-tuning the numbers. So when we look at our combined financial results, I highlighted in the our November 4th presentation down here was 57.3, and this is 58.1. Approximately, it's that $800,000. And there's more detail in your appendix on that. It's really just fine-tuning. Looking at our capital expenditures, again, the November 4th presentation had about $151.5 million. Again, this is showing that $170.1 million. That's the $18.5 million I just referred to earlier. So this is where... This is, in addition to approving the 2020 budget, as I mentioned on November 4th, you also approved the total project budget. So this is a list of existing capital projects that are going to be revised, and these are projects that are greater than $1 million revisions. It excludes public power benefit and any recurring capital programs. I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. These really didn't change really materially, but they were a change, so I did want to highlight them. This Rock Island facilities upgrade, this in the presentation you would have got as a draft, this would have been $4,322,000. This is actually the adjustment that will be in the final resolution of $4.2 million. So I did change this just so I could highlight that there will be a change, and I'll talk about it earlier. I just didn't want to run through all the numbers without really fine-tuning everything. These are new capital projects that are greater than $1 million, and I think I alluded to this, and on November 4th, we were expecting the Rocky Reach Headgate stop block dewatering pumps to possibly change. It did change. They did add a few dollars to that. That's the only highlighted change for new projects. So looking at our total district expenditures, really this is kind of a highlight of basically the capital expenditures. It went from $382.4 million to $401.2 million. That's primarily the capital expenditures. I would expect, with no other changes on the resolution that's presented on December 2nd, that this will go down to $122,000, as I alluded to, based on that Rock Island storage facilities. And looking at, and we take into our debt principal payments, nothing changed there. So that differential flows through to our total budget presentation on November 4th from a 421.5 to 440.2. Looking at our combined district financial policies for 2020, again, moving that capital number, accelerating that, really doesn't change the needle on any of these numbers. They're very consistent to what we had in 2020, the presentation on November 4th. And looking at our combined district policy metrics over the next five-year window, again, that doesn't move the needle much either, because it was just an acceleration of capital costs from the outer years to the current year. So all these, this slide is basically unchanged from the previous presentation. So hopefully I identified that was, I mean, there's not a lot of detail because there's not a lot of changes. And all the detail is included in the appendix. So the next steps are to respond to any questions, provide any additional detail that may be requested. And we will be coming to the board on December 2nd with a resolution requesting adoption of the 2020 budget.
You know, I'm just going to add, a $170 million capital budget may seem unlikely to be achieved, to be honest. After shooting for 150, and you saw in the third quarter review, we're thinking we're more at about 100 this year. The only thing I can say is we do know most of this work is really at the hydro projects, and we under our current schedules, this is what it would take to do it. Whether we can do all that or not is open question, but I'd rather not give up now and say we can't, and there's not really a cost to going for the higher level. We're not, it's not causing us to not do something else that we would otherwise be able to accomplish. Financially, we're in position to be able to. If we needed, if we were able to carry out this program, to be able to afford the program. So I guess I'd prefer to set the bar high and see if we can achieve it.
Mm-hmm. Questions, comments?
I'm just shaking my head on this, our financial metrics. I mean, that's just a dream. That's, any other utility would look at that and just, you know, just wouldn't even believe how great it is. I mean, we're so above our targets, even in the unusual case, base case. So phenomenal. Terrific.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay. Now we're on to our consent agenda. We've not made any changes.
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Second.
Any discussion, comments? That said, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Approved unanimously. Okay. Now we are on resolution number 11.
This should be resolution 12. A resolution declaring ABB Incorporated of Princeton, New Jersey as the sole source supplier for the materials and equipment necessary for the generator breaker rebuild and repair for Rock Island, and authorizing the general manager to enter into a contract with ABB Incorporated for, one, the purchase of the materials and equipment necessary to the generator breaker rebuild and repair, and two, for the rebuild and repair work. John, welcome.
Afternoon. I'm John Yale. I'm the Hydro Plant Engineering Manager.
And I'm Salim Ghazi. I'm the project manager for this project.
So as Steve described, this is a sole source resolution to ABB for rebuild services for the generator circuit breakers down at Rock Island. The breakers were originally installed in the early 2000s, and our asset management programs identified that every 15 to 20 years, we need to go through and rebuild the breaker operators and change out some of the breaker parts themselves to ensure another renewal life, make it through the period that we're counting on the breakers. So ABB was the original breakers, original manufacturer and designer of the breakers that were installed in the 2000s. and they are the only ones that can provide the parts and the factory-trained service engineers and technicians in order to do the work. They don't provide training to any third parties for this type of work. So in order to get it done with factory parts, factory technicians, and get the warranty from it, we need to use ABB. This is a similar program to what we've done up at Rocky Reach, where we've done the same thing with ABB successfully. We've managed our schedule very well up there for this. And Salim will describe a little bit how he's going to implement the work.
Yes, I mean, basically there will be two phases. We'll remove the old actuator, send it to ABB shop for them to refurbish it to today's standards. And at the same time, the second phase would be they will send an ABB engineer on site, and under his supervision, our electricians will install the actuator and refurbish the rest of the breaker and get it up to standards. So basically, this project will start this winter and will go on till 2024, so we can refurbish all the 8 units as the outage happens on the units. We'll schedule this breaker, and so we're not taking any downtime for that purpose.
So I said, this is similar to how we've done it up at Rocky Reach, utilizing a spare actuator. They do the work back in New Jersey, ship it out, and we replace it just in a few days outage time. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Good.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
All right, our next item is agenda item 13. It's also closely related to agenda item 14. This is a resolution authorizing the general manager to execute individual task authorizations under interagency agreement SA number 15-123 with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to operate the fish hatchery programs required in the licenses for the Rocky Reach, Rock Island, and Lake Chelan hydroelectric projects. Lean, welcome. Ian, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. We're here again this year to talk about the resolution for DFW. I'm Aline Underwood, Manager of Fish and Wildlife, and with me today to present all the details is Ian Adams, our Hatchery Program Maintenance Coordinator.
Thanks, Aline. Thanks, Commissioners and Steve, for the quick overview there of the purpose of this resolution. A few important facts about the 2020 hatchery operations are that the agreement with WDFW provides for annual review and negotiation of the budgets as they come in, and that work assures that the operations are going to be or keep us in compliance with FERC obligations and that we can continue our cost effectiveness. And district staff also review all invoices that come in on a monthly basis from DFW for correctness and adherence to contracts before we make any payments. The total cost for hatchery operations for 2020 is expected to not exceed $3,289,487. Now, this is a 12.04% increase over the 2019 hatchery operations, and the reason for these increases is largely due to staffing pay rate increases and COLA. In addition, DFW's indirect increased by about 5% over last year's indirect rate.
What is that? How much is that indirect rate?
The current 2020 indirect rate will be 30.29%, and 2018 was 28.79%.
And that covers their overhead?
It covers their overhead, yes. And their overhead has traditionally fluctuated up and down quite a bit. And this is not the highest indirect we've paid, but it's close to it in the last decade or so.
Okay.
In addition, the Hatchery Department recognizes that this increase is pretty sizable, and that we're committing to continuing to look at contracting alternatives for hatchery operations in the future, and we will respond back to the board in 2020 with what we find. And lastly, I want to say that it's highly important to note that Grant PUD also shares a large funding component of our hatchery operations, approximately about 20%. So their total expected contribution to our hatchery operations for 2020 will be $687,318 next year. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take those now.
I think we should say something about the concern we've got over the increase in cost here. This issue has come up before, and I think we've generally felt like, well, you know, the administrative costs are not out of line, and overall the costs are probably lower than what we would incur if we were trying to take this responsibility on for ourselves. But this particular increase has definitely got our attention. And so we are questioning whether there is a reduced value of relying on WDFW for managing these hatcheries. We're not able to make a shift on a dime here and move to a different approach and do something starting the next calendar year. But we do have the capability, and this resolution calls for an evaluation of alternatives to consider what other choices we have. Because, again, the competitive advantage that WDFW has offered in the past is being reduced with the size of this increase. So our expectation is that we would perform that analysis and get back to the board in 2020 with adequate time to be able to make a decision about if we wanted to do something different, what that would be for 2021.
Well, I was going to say, striking out on our own is not without precedent in this area, as our neighbors have done it.
Mm-hmm. And there are things that we can learn from that. We'll have to see. In fact, that would be part of our evaluation, would be to go learn what we can from their experience. Lean, anything you'd want to add to that?
No, I think the only thing I'd add is, as Steve mentioned, this is something that we've spent a lot of time thinking about in the past. You know, we did a very back of the napkin cursory analysis when Douglas went on their own a couple of years ago. At that time, it wasn't fiscally prudent for the district to do that. But one of the things that's made DFW so affordable for us in the past, frankly, is because their pay rates haven't been very competitive. So what we're seeing is DFW in an attempt to move toward more competitive pay rates. That's causing us to take another look at, if they're competitive, how do they compete with our own rates? And are there any alternatives out there other than doing something like Douglas did? Based on what we know so far, there aren't any other entities or consultants that provide such a service for hatchery operations. Mm. That doesn't mean that we can't figure out a different way to look at our hatchery programs.
So that was what my question was going to be. I always had the sense that we didn't have any other options other than to do it ourselves. And so I was going to ask you, are there other options out there? Do the tribes do it? Are there private businesses that contract for that? So not to our knowledge right now.
That's correct. But that will be something we'll be taking a deeper look at in 2020.
Good. Yeah.
Okay, I think we'll move on to the next one, which has a similar paragraph in it to the one that you found in the last one. So you'll recognize the discussion here. This is Agenda 14, a resolution authorizing the general manager to enter into an interagency agreement, SA number 19-10432, with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to perform hatchery monitoring and evaluation activities required in the licenses for Rocky Reach and Rock Island hydroelectric projects for calendar year 2020.
Yes, and with me to present all the details is Catherine Willard, who's our senior fisheries biologist, who works day in, day out, making sure that our hatchery maintenance, monitoring and evaluation program is not only implemented, but at the best cost we can with all the contractors that we have.
Good afternoon. So as Steve mentioned, we're required through the Rock Island and Rocky Reach HCPs to monitor and evaluate the district's hatchery programs to ensure their effectiveness. And we have a monitoring plan that the hatchery committees have approved that we have requirements to answer the objectives stated within the monitoring plan to evaluate the programs. To do this, we are requesting authorization to execute a one-year interagency agreement with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to conduct monitoring and evaluation activities to support the district's hatchery programs. The not-to-exceed price for hatchery monitoring evaluation for this contract in 2020 is $1,093,205, which is a 5.21% increase over the amount budgeted in 2019. This increase is 2 months of wages were reallocated from the Hatchery Ops budget that was just presented, reallocated to the Hatchery M&E budget. And that was resulted in a 2.26% increase of the 5.21% increase. The remaining increase was the result of the state-authorized COLA and also the indirect rate increase that Ian was just explaining. And like Steve mentioned, while the Hatchery M&E budget, it does not include as significant of an increase as the Hatchery Ops budget, we acknowledge that this is a considerable amount of money and to conduct proposed M&E services. And we also will commit to do an alternative analysis to figure out other ways and more cost-effective ways to conduct our M&E activities. Are there any questions?
So do you think that WDFW is aware that we're looking hard at this increase and that we may be looking at other options?
Yes. I actually personally called the Region 2 director to give him a heads up that this was coming, but this is not a new topic for him. Especially since Douglas went on their own a few years ago. They've been very willing to talk about how they set their rates and all of that. So we've been talking to them about this.
Has there been any conversation with Douglas in terms of, you know, how their decision's working out for them?
Yes, we do touch base with Douglas in a couple of different forums. We have ad hoc meetings to just really talk about the nuts and bolts of how are things working to take it all inside. Catherine experiences that through interactions with the Hatchery Committee, with our other stakeholders that are signatories to the HCP. So we do have a sense of how that's going for them, and we'll use that to evaluate sort of our options next year. But that is, just to be clear, that is on that Hatchery operations side. Mm-hmm. For the monitoring evaluation, Douglas still contracts with DFW as well, okay. Mm-hmm. As do we. We have other contracts with other contractors for different portions of our M&E as well.
Stay tuned.
Yes, sir.
Well, I can, and I appreciate the question, Anna, because as much as I can appreciate the fact of the situation they're in with wages, it does, you know, start to open up and people need to start having honest discussions and continue to look at options. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, commissioners?
No. Good. Thank you.
Do I have a motion for 12, 13, and 14?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of Resolutions 12, 13, and 14 as presented.
Second.
Any discussion on any three of those? Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Steve, we'll finish up with manager items.
Yeah, we have two left. Would like to ask Justin Erickson to come up and join us for a follow-up on the supported employment position that we discussed about a month ago.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services. As Steve indicated, I'm going to provide you a brief update on the supported employment position. As you recall, that's a part-time, temporary position where we provide candidates or those filling that role job experience and opportunity, and those people have cognitive disabilities. And this program is funded through Public Power Benefit. On October 7th, you had the opportunity to meet Sydney Lackey and view a video that highlighted the work she does and the impact that the program has had on her and on the district. I think it's fair to say it's been a moving experience for all of us involved, And we actually have a second employee that's starting in December in a similar role. Our overall goals for this program have been as follows. To provide opportunity for adult persons with cognitive disability in our community to develop necessary skills to be successful for long-term employment, to develop a model for employers to support, train, and benefit from employing persons with cognitive disabilities, to address underrepresented populations in our community and add diversity to the workforce, and lastly, to give staff the opportunity to experience and embrace working with different skill sets. As was noted that day, the program was in the process of being evaluated now that we've done this for about 9 months or so. And we've been exploring ways to continue the positive impact, and make the very most of this pilot program. Based on our evaluation of the program, I am pleased to report that we have decided to maintain Citi's position through 2020. This can be accomplished within the original PPB funded allocation. And this extension of time will allow us to better realize the goal of the program and will also allow Citi to excel and grow by being presented with new opportunities and additional responsibilities. So I'd like to thank the Commission and the General Manager for your support of this program. I look forward to bringing you a more comprehensive update in 2020 as this further develops. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Ann.
Yes, Commissioner.
Are we going to continue to have supported, is she going to continue to be supported? Or will the level of support kind of tail off?
Yes, both are true. She will have continued support, but that support is that level of support is based on the activities that she's engaged in and her progress. And during her tenure already, that support has been lessened through time.
As she's become more competent.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, great. Good.
Worthy endeavor. Thank you,
Justin.
Sir. Thank
yes,
you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I want to take a moment and brag on a part of our group. So told you recently that we finished our reliability audit with WEC and that they gave us very high scores. We also, there's something called the Reliability Assurance Initiative. It comes out of the Pacific Southwest outage that occurred, I think it was 2012. It was a number of years ago. And there was a concern that the Western interconnection was not hitting the standards that was necessary. So there was a lot of pressure on the West generally to do more. And WEC initiated this Reliability Assurance Initiative where they engage with the various registered entities in the interconnection to talk about emerging issues and then making sure that people are aware of and taking action on those. They then give all the folks in the interconnection an annual letter to say, how are you doing? So we got our letter late last week, and there's a sentence in there I thought was worthy of calling to your attention. I haven't seen a sentence like this before. Chelan is leading the interconnection in its approach to operations in pursuit of continuous improvement. So I just want to remember the interconnection is the entire Western United States. There are an awful lot of entities within that. It's unusual for WEC to call out and describe where you sit relative to your peers. Mm-hmm. And the doing better than everyone else, it was a pretty powerful statement. Embedded in that document was also this graphic that you see up there, where they identified five different characteristics that they think are important to operating in the interconnection. And on a 1 to 5 scale, how you're doing, the gray area is the average for the interconnection. The orange is how Chelan PUD scored. You can see that we scored better than average on all. Mm. Actually led the interconnection in one element and nothing less than a 4 in the other 4. Mm. So it's a really powerful statement. I think particularly Chad Bowman and his group there deserves commendation. We took this over and visited with our group last week, actually, to share with them and left them a poster board that they can hang on their wall to describe the incredibly great work that they are doing. You know, one of our goals is to be great, and
certainly in one area of our operation, we're getting feedback that that's happening.
Wow, that's amazing.
And
what just happened to, you read through it and you just happened to see that?
Well, the letter is to me.
Okay.
So the letter is to the leader of each organization. Each gets one, and it's only a 3-page letter, so it wasn't hard to read through it. And you do wonder, you know, what are they saying? It's kind of an important letter that comes all the time. So.
Yeah.
How are we doing? And are we measuring up? What I didn't expect was that kind of comparison against others.
Mm-hmm.
Good. All right.
Very good.
It's kind of an interesting graphic because when I first looked at it, to me, it looked like a target. We were not in the middle of the target. You know, the closer to the edge, the stronger you are.
But the way it's designed, no matter where you were, you couldn't get in the middle of it because it's irregular.
Yeah. I think it looks like a pentagon that I drew.
So this is a graph that we see in schools. Quite often, and I don't think I've ever seen an organization that has been outside of all areas. So that's impressive to me.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, most organizations have their pluses and their minuses areas to grow, but that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Very good. Right. Anything else on manager items, Steve?
No.
Okay. Now we're on to commission items. Commissioners, do you have anything? All right. Follow up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
We've got one we're still working on, the depreciation timeline for Nine Canyons. It's a small one. Just trying. It's the same group that's working on budget right now, so it just hasn't risen to the top of the list, to be honest, but we'll get that one to you. You did hear back from Michelle today on the Horan Natural Area meetings. That was one of our commitments. Mike Coleman says he's very close on his notes from the fiber meetings, and he would expect that to come up before the next board meeting. I do want to tell you that we are struggling with, as we have implemented National Electric Safety Code requirements, we are struggling right now with being able to keep up on the number of days between when a customer contacts us and we're able to get out to hook them up for fiber service. We're well below our target at the moment. You heard that at third quarter. We've slipped even further in the last couple of weeks. And we are looking at whether there's something that we need to do on the FTE side to try to address that was not included in the budget. It was not included in the presentation that I made to you last time with respect to FTE, but we are at risk of losing customers and wait too long and people will go someplace else to get the service. And we have just recently hit the 50% target, where 50% of the residents passed are now receiving Chelan PUD fiber. We want that number to continue to grow and certainly not to slip. So Mike and I are in the middle of a conversation about that. I would expect that we will have something for you to present at the next board meeting on that subject.
Steve, in terms of budget, is it possible, if the issue is FTE, is it possible to put a budget placeholder in for additional FTEs in that area if that is a resolution to the issue of not being able to maintain schedule?
Yes. I mean, we first of all, we often take board guidance during the middle of a year and change the budget. So it's not a problem to do that. I think it would be unlikely that we would try to embed a decision in the December budget decision. It's too late in the process to do that, and to be honest, it's not worth it for the relatively small amount of dollars that would be at stake here. But we can catch up later. But I have a commitment to you that we're not adding FTE unless the board knows about it. And so it's because of that commitment that I want to bring it back to you and talk to you about it.
Well, and my question is, based on support for maintaining that schedule and maintaining growth in our customer arena on fiber. It's one of the essentials.
Right. Well, you'll get a chance to express that at the next board meeting.
Thank you.
And then we've got one other one that we completed, and that's the governance board governance policy review that Eric sent out on November 6th in response to the discussion at the board workshop. If there are any feedback, get it to Eric. I think there also is a subcommittee of Commissioner Arsenault, Commissioner McKenna on governance issues. Also, I just encourage that they be kept in the loop as well on any comments that you may have. Okay. And that's it.
Delegation of action items from this meeting?
Yeah, we didn't hear any. So if we missed something, let us know. Okay.
All right.
I had just one, but it was kind of it was just an ask, kind of an indirect ask of, let's think about women in public power next year. Think of, okay. Interested.
Okay. Well, what we can do is, talk about how we will get that word out.
And even though I didn't get an exact answer, I think the round number of 30,000 polls is a good answer.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Oh, you did that. Oh, man.
I saw John sitting behind you, and I just couldn't resist.
Number changes day by day. So.
Yeah. There you go.
You can send John out and count them.
It changes driver by driver.
Yeah.
Okay, I look around. I don't see any public here for additional public comment. Any other matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission? With that said, we will move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is likely to become a party, and or legal risk. And Eric, am I doing the evaluation of an employee?
Yes, please.
Okay. And to review the performance of a public employee.
We need about 30 minutes.
Okay, 30 minutes. So we will adjourn and come back after executive session. Okay, we are coming out of executive session. It is November 18th, 2019. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we stand adjourned.